Lyndell Baker and others against Sandra Cohn. Mr. Carroll, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The question in these two consolidated cases is whether an ostensibly private school, which is retained by the state to discharge the state's obligation to provide special education, acts under color of law when it dismisses several of its teachers for criticizing the manner in which that education is provided. Petitioners are six former teachers and counselors at Respondent New Perspective School in Brookline, Massachusetts. They allege they were dismissed for fulfilling their professional duty to speak out on school matters affecting the education of their students. Although the school is ostensibly private, all 50 of its students were placed there by state agencies or local school committees under the Massachusetts Special Education Statute. Each child's educational program was prescribed by public officials. State agencies or local school committees also paid each child's tuition, with the result that as much as 99% of the school's operating funds were derived from public sources. Thus, the school had no students except those which had been placed there by public officials. It had virtually no operating funds except those which had been provided by public officials. It was contractually obligated to implement educational programs prescribed by public officials, and it had no function except to discharge the Commonwealth's own obligation to provide special education to students which public officials had placed at the school.
Who owns the building and properties?
The building and properties are privately owned by the school's trustees.
Who selects the teachers?
The teachers are selected by the school management, including the directors and the executive director of the school.
Are any of them public officials?
No. Under the circumstances of this case, petitioners submit that the school is subject to the same constitutional obligations as an ordinary public school in connection with the performance of its educational activities. To place the issue into its proper context, it is important to understand more fully the statutory scheme under which special education is provided in Massachusetts. Chapter 766 of the Acts of 1972 confers upon every school-age child a statutory right to receive suitable, publicly funded education. If a child is suspected of having special learning needs, he is evaluated by a team of educators, physicians, and psychologists appointed by the state. If the team determines that the child does have special learning needs, then it formulates an individualized educational plan, or IEP, to meet those needs. The IEP establishes educational objectives for the child and sets out in detail an educational program designed to achieve those objectives. By law, the IEP must be implemented by the child's regular public school to the fullest extent possible. If the regular public school is unable to implement the IEP, then but only then may the school committee place the child in a specially accredited private school, such as the respondent in this case. The school must agree to implement the IEP and to submit to extensive state regulation and inspection. It must also report periodically on the child's progress with a view toward returning him to the public school as soon as possible. For its part, the school committee must pay each child's tuition, and it also must monitor the child's progress and the school's performance. The school committee also has an ongoing obligation to revise the child's IEP as the need arises. If the regular public school is unable to implement the IEP, and if the school committee is unable to locate a suitable private school which is willing and able to do so, then by law the school committee must establish a suitable program of its own. So in short, every school-aged child has an unconditional right to suitable education, and the Commonwealth has an absolute duty to provide it. It's also significant that that school attendance was made compulsory under Chapter 766 for children entitled to special educational benefits. This, then, was the statutory scheme under which state agencies or local school committees provided the school with all of its students and virtually all of its operating funds.
Did the Court of Appeals for the First Circuit agree with all of your positions as to the statutory law of Massachusetts?
I don't know of any disagreement that they expressed with any of these positions. The dismissals which gave rise to the litigation were all alleged to have been in retaliation for petitioner's speech critical of school policies and administration. It was against this background and on these facts, which, as I've noted, the First Circuit assumed to be true for purposes of its opinion, that petitioners maintain that the school is subject to the same constitutional obligations as an ordinary public school in connection with the performance of its educational activities.
Well, isn't that true of every private school? It must meet state standards.
We think that there is a critical difference in this case. An ordinary private school is not discharging an obligation of the Commonwealth or of a state when it provides education, because the children who attend that school have chosen to reject the education which the state is required to offer. The school in this case was clearly discharging an obligation of the Commonwealth, not only in the sense that the Commonwealth was paying for the education and had prescribed the educational program for the child, but that the Commonwealth would have had to provide this education itself. These were children who had come forward to claim the special educational benefits which the state was statutorily obligated to provide. We contend that the school is subject to constitutional obligations on two principal grounds.
You say there's a great difference between this situation and the situation the Chief Justice posed to you, but isn't the state by statute required to furnish an education for everybody?
Yes, it is required to furnish an education.
If somebody wants to go to public school, he has a right to go to public school.
Yes.
By statute?
Yes.
And if he chooses to go to private school instead, why, that is at least a replacement for a state obligation, isn't it? It's a substitute for a state obligation as long as the state approves it as an adequate substitute.
It is a substitute for the obligation of the child.
How is that different from this situation, other than for the financing?
Because the private school in that case is providing education to children who have, either they or their parents, have chosen to reject the public education which the state provides.
Well, I know that may be one way of talking about it, but it nevertheless is discharging a state obligation in both cases.
Well,
at least it's a substitute for a state obligation.
It is a substitute, but
and furthermore, the child is discharging his obligation in the same way in both cases.
That is correct. The child is discharging his obligation to attend a school.
Mm-hmm. And the state is... The state is relieved of an obligation in both cases.
Well, the state would still have an obligation.
It is relieved of an obligation to do it itself.
That is correct. The important point that we wish to emphasize is that when the school provides education, in this case to these children, it is discharging an obligation of the state and performing a sovereign function as an agent or instrumentality of the Commonwealth. When state agencies or state employees provide services in discharge of the Commonwealth's obligation, they, of course, must observe constitutional standards when they do so. The question, then, in this case is whether a different standard should apply when the state elects to deliver those same services through a closely controlled agent like the school, rather than through its own full-time employees. We maintain that the same standard must apply in either case, because states should not have it within their discretion to avoid constitutional obligations by the simple expediency of farming out their statutory obligations. The existence or non-existence of constitutional rights must not be permitted to turn upon formal distinctions between agents who are on the state payroll and those who aren't. If states are permitted to retain alter egos like the school to deliver essential services. And if those alter egos are as free to disregard constitutional rights as the state chooses to permit them to be, then citizens will ultimately be dependent upon nothing more than the will of the state for
protection. Well, suppose a city has an obligation to provide roads and streets and bridges and things like that, which it does, and it contracts with a construction firm to build a bridge. It certainly has standards that they have to live up to. They put out for bids, and they have the specifications, and they agree to pay a certain amount of money. They finance the entire deal. Do you think that makes that independent contractor a state instrumentality for purposes of the 14th Amendment?
Not necessarily. We would distinguish cases in which a private entity is performing a function on behalf of the state from situations in which it is not, and we would distinguish it on the basis of whether or not the private entity's conduct substantially and materially affects the delivery of the particular service, so that under this functional analysis...
Well, suppose the fellow in charge of Bill, who had the superintendent of the job, is fired. He's been in charge, and midway through the building of the bridge, he gets discharged for a reason that he says is violates his due process rights. Wouldn't that have as much of an impact on the delivery of the state services as the discharge in this case?
I don't believe so. I think the distinction is that when a school fires teachers for fulfilling a professional duty to speak out on professional matters, on educational matters affecting students, that there is not only the immediate impact of losing those particular teachers, but that all teachers at that school then and in the future know that they risk dismissal for expressing those types of professional opinions.
What if Justice White's hypothetical employee working on this bridge spoke up and said that the company was not building the bridge correctly? And that it was might endanger the public.
In most cases,
would that be any different?
In most cases, I would say yes, it would be different.
Unless he thinks he's speaking out to protect the public.
Unless that particular individual has a position of responsibility, under which it is his job, in discharging the obligation of the state, in this case, to say what he's saying.
He's hired to build a bridge, not to talk.
If he is the superintendent of the job, that is correct. But if you take, for example, a truck driver or somebody who is laying the concrete and is criticizing the design of the bridge and is speaking in public forums, I would say that the private contracting company would have a right to discharge that individual because...
Not the superintendent, do you think?
If it is the superintendent's position to express opinions concerning the safety of the project, then in that case, I would say that he would have a right to speak out, to the same extent that the state engineer in charge of the project would have a right to do so.
Mr. Carroll, this is not a state institution, is it?
It is a private institution, yes, Your Honor.
And the employees are not state employees.
They are not employees of the state. They are not on the state.
How do they get under the 14th Amendment?
They are acting under the color of law in the sense that they are agents or instrumentalities.
How are they agents? They're not paid by the state, are they?
They are not on the state payroll.
Weren't hired by the state, were they?
They were not hired by the state.
Well, how did they become state officials?
They are paid by funds provided by the state, and they are subject to the control of
the
state.
That's true as to Harvard's too, isn't it?
Excuse me?
There are some people at Harvard that are paid with federal funds too, aren't they?
But they are not discharging...
And that's still private, isn't it?
That is still private. They are not discharging any obligation of the Commonwealth to deliver the educational services which they are delivering.
I just don't understand how they become state employees.
They don't become state employees.
And my state is in quotes.
They become instrumentalities.
And I think you need those quotes to get under the 14th Amendment.
Well, as the so, court...
I mean, persuade me I'm wrong.
As the court said in Evans versus Newton, and this is the quote from the opinion, when private individuals or groups are endowed by the state with powers or functions governmental in nature, they become agencies or instrumentalities of the state and subject to its constitutional limitations. Now, there have been several opinions by this court in which private entities have been held subject to constitutional obligations. For example, in Burton versus Wilmington Parking Authority, the Eagle Coffee Shop was, of course, private.
Did that case say that the employees were state employees? They weren't even involved. The employees weren't involved in the case.
No. That case said that the...
Well, I'm still waiting for one that'll help you.
They become...
I think that's your problem.
They are not state employees, but I don't believe the 14th Amendment requires or applies only to employees. I believe that it applies to persons who are acting under color of law, and that when the private employee is discharging an obligation of
the
commonwealth...
Well, suppose the private employee makes a speech to a private student. Would that be protected by the 14th Amendment?
Under the circumstances in which it would... if under the circumstances...
I gave you the circumstances. In the school, he got a group of private students who were paying their tuition and told them, made a speech to them. Is that a protected speech?
If these were private students who had not been sent there by the Commonwealth, the answer is no. It would be a private speech.
Well, what was this speech made to? Only public students?
There were no students at this school except students who had been sent by state agencies or local school committees. All 50 of the students had been placed there by the state.
And was that done after? Was that school open before the statute or after?
There isn't anything in the record about the history of the school. I believe it was opened shortly before the statute. And I don't know if there's anything. I believe there's nothing in the record as to whether it ever had any students except
well,
those placed by the state.
You go down all of the indicia of a state employee, and they don't have any. Do they take an oath to the state?
They did not take an oath, but they signed a contract which provided that they would discharge the obligation of the Commonwealth to
implement
the IEP. And so
the bootleggers signed contracts, too, weren't they?
Excuse me?
The fact they signed a contract doesn't have anything to do with my point. Well, did they sign a contract with the state?
Yes, with the local school committees and
with
state,
the state
agencies. Agents of the state or instrumentalities of the state,
they
state
filed,
agencies.
They filed a contract to teach and to be paid. Did they file it with the school or the school board?
No. I mean the school. Perhaps I misunderstood Your Honor's question.
I thought you did.
The school itself signs a contract with the state agency.
The state didn't have anything to do with it. The state is a... They are completely different groups of people.
They are different groups of people, but the state is responsible for the students being there. It's responsible for the school's existence. If I may draw an analogy to other decisions by this court, for example, Williams versus United States, reported at 341 U.S. reports, was a case where a private security policeman was held subject to constitutional obligations in a criminal case, the counterpart of the civil statute involved here, because he was acting under a license by the state, and he beat up a group of private employees.
Which license gave him a right to carry a gun and kill somebody?
Well,
what did these teachers have from the state? What license, if any?
They were accredited by the state to teach, but that does not distinguish them from ordinary public school teachers. However, in order to teach in the New Perspective School or other accredited schools, you must receive the same comparable certification to public school teachers, which is a higher certification than the certification
required. Isn't that true for all private schools?
No, it is not.
Really?
The certification
well,
requires...
some states it is, right? Some states have the same certification.
I don't know the answer to that. I would not be surprised. But in Massachusetts, the certification requirements are now higher for special education teachers in private schools than for ordinary teachers. Now...
Mr. Carroll, even if the school is acting in a sovereign role as to the students, how can you argue that the school is acting in a sovereign role with regard to its personnel policies? Where is the nexus?
The nexus,
for personnel policies.
The nexus comes from the fact that it is the function of providing education which is important here. Under what we would maintain the dysfunctional approach to be, the school should be subject to the same constitutional obligations as an ordinary public school to the extent its conduct has a material effect on the delivery of the service. And firing.
Mr. Carroll, it is a concern because a number of cities and counties and governmental units in the country are contracting with private employers, if you will, to perform certain functions. For example, fire protection or garbage pickup services. This is a rather widespread practice around the country. Under your theory, then, all of these employees of these private contractors with a city or a county would now be considered to be engaged in state action. Is that right?
State action for some purposes, not necessarily all purposes. That would be state action only to the extent that the challenged conduct had a material effect on the delivery of the service, so that there would might well be instances where the private security police, for example, or the private firemen would not be subject to constitutional obligations. They would only be in connection with those activities which the private citizen who is receiving the benefit of that service will expect will have a material effect on the quality of the service itself. Now, under
your theory, I take it that any labor management dispute in the company that was providing the trash service or the fire protection service would affect the delivery of the service, since you're basically dealing with a labor management dispute here at the New Perspective School.
I think what is more important than the particular episode is whether a rule of law which says that the private entity may do something or other might have the effect on the future delivery of that service. For example, if we take a case of a private maintenance company which is plowing city streets, I think that if the maintenance company plowed the streets in the minority ethnic neighborhoods last, over and over, that conduct is clearly affecting the quality of the delivery of the service and it should be subject to a constitutional obligation. However, when that same maintenance company makes decisions about who it's going to hire or what equipment it's going to buy or who it's going to buy equipment from, the impact on the quality of the service is substantially less. And that's why I come back in this case to the point that if teachers know that they may be discharged for expressing professional opinions about the quality of education, then the quality of education will seriously suffer.
Well, what if one of several supervisors of a private fire company that's employed by a city to furnish fire protection services makes a statement to the press that this organization is poorly run from top to bottom and follows antiquated fire protection procedures and we ought to get rid of top management?
Well, I think that this is similar to the question before about the bridge supervisor. If this person is simply an individual who is expressing his own opinions and is not in a position which confers upon him the responsibility to express opinions of that type, then when he is discharged for expressing such opinions, he is company discharging him is exercising a private function, is performing a private function because this particular individual's speech is probably not any significantly more important than any other individual's speech insofar as that quality of service is concerned. And you do have to separate the functions of the private entity, which are private, from the functions of the private entity, which are public. I think the state action requirement, the primary purpose is to protect a zone of privacy, to establish a zone of privacy. And it is a sensitive balancing of interests which is involved here.
Well, you would have I would think, a stronger case if there had been some express permission. Say a state statute said, you may fire any of your people without a hearing, without losing your grant, without losing your... And the school fired somebody without a hearing.
I think...
But there isn't even that here, is there?
No, what there is an abdication of responsibility, and I think that that is akin to the situation you had in the so-called white primary cases, where the Democratic Party, particularly, for example, in Terry versus Adams, was not retained by the state to determine voter eligibility requirements in general elections. But the state, in effect, abdicated responsibility to the party to permit it to determine eligibility requirements in the only elections which counted, namely the Democratic pre-primaries, so that in that case, the party was held subject to constitutional obligations to the extent the state permitted it to perform that function. So that I think abdication of responsibility, or as in this case, an express delegation of responsibility, is a substitute for the kind of regulatory involvement that the court has dealt with from time to time, where the private entity is ordered to do something. We are certainly not dealing with a case where a private entity has been ordered to do something. We are dealing with a case where the state has expressly retained the private entity to discharge an obligation of the state to provide an essential service.
Mr. Carroll, would your argument be the same if this particular school had only one or two students out of the public sector for which the state is paying?
In that case, I think we would acknowledge that the school would be performing a dual function. To the extent it is providing education to those one or two students, certainly it is discharging a public obligation. But it is also performing a private obligation. The parents who send their children to that school voluntarily do have a right, an important right, to have those children taught in a manner and by people that they are comfortable with. I think that to the extent you can separate the dual nature of the function, you should do so. For example, I think it would be unconstitutional for the school you describe to threaten one student with dismissal for writing a letter to a local paper if that
well,
one
what
student...
What about this case? If the school had only one student publicly funded, would you think that your regulatory argument would stand up here?
I think in that case you would have to say which function predominates, and in that case I would say the private function predominates. I would say that the likelihood is in that case that the school had taken that one student more as an accommodation to the state than in order to provide for its own continued existence. And that would be a different case than the one we have here, where the school obviously was depending upon the state for its very existence because all of its students were provided by the state. I would like to reserve the balance of my time.
Excuse me. Did they get any private money? Is it in the record?
I think there were 2 years covered in the discovery. In one year, it was about 9%. In the second year, it was 1%. Of operating funds. I don't know what the endowment is of the school. I don't believe that's in the record. But in the second year with which this case is concerned, 99% of the operating funds were provided by the state. Thank you.
Mr. Feinberg.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The New Perspective School is a private, autonomous, independent private school. It retains all of the essential characteristics of a private school. Nothing in its operation or in the operation of the Massachusetts Special Education Statute, Chapter 766, alters the essential private nature of that school. The school was incorporated in 1971.
Most private schools don't get 99% of their funds from the state either.
That is correct, Your Honor. The fact, however, that the school gets that kind of money through the state in no way alters the essential private characteristics of the school. That is to say, with regard to who goes to the school, who teaches at the school, and what the teachers teach at the school itself, and only the school, retains the decision-making authority.
You mean the State Board of Education has no jurisdiction over the school at all?
The State Board of Education has regulatory authority.
Well, I thought so.
But it does not have direct control in the sense that it does not have any control over the decision-making powers of the school in its day-to-day operation, who it hires, who it fires, and indeed who even goes to the school.
Well, did you suggest that the students are selected only by the school and not assigned by the state?
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. What happens in the admission policy of the school is as follows. A referring public agency, such as a school committee, will send over to the school the child and usually, in fact, always, the child's parents. An interview is arranged, a certain amount of testing is accomplished, and at that point, what is known as the individual educational plan is developed. That plan is looked at by the school, and a decision is made whether or not to admit that child to the school. The school may at that...
school committee?
I'm sorry?
Is that the school committee?
That is not the school committee, Your Honor.
What
that
does
is
the school committee do?
All the school committee does, the ultimate, the last responsibility of the school committee is to refer a child whom they have deemed to be qualified for a private placement outside of the public school system.
And that is a public committee, not a private committee.
The referral itself is the public function of the school committee.
Pursuant
the decision,
to state law.
That is correct under the chapter.
Pursuant to state law.
That is correct. The decision, however, of whether or not to accept that child rests with the school.
And if the child is rejected, how does the state or the school board discharge its obligation to provide special education?
It must discharge its obligation by referring that child to another school. And another school whereby that child's individual educational plan is more consonant with that other school.
And if this process ends up that no other school will take the child, then we'll house the child education.
Then the public school must establish its own program for the school within the public school system. There is there is an obligation upon the public school system to do something for that child, but it is not necessarily so that the child must go to the New Perspective School or any other privately operated institution.
Now, actually, in the 2 years involved here, how many of the children at New Perspective School were referred by some public school board?
I believe the percentages were, it was over 80%. 43 students were referred by public school systems. 7 students came through other state agencies. The other state agencies, Your Honor, were the Department...
Well, are there any of them who had not been referred by some state agency?
Not in the 2 years in question, Your Honor. All 50 of these students were referred by some state agency. However, the school...
How many referred children were rejected?
The record is totally silent with regard to that, Your Honor. It is clear, however, that the school has the authority to reject students. It has the authority as well to admit private referrals that are outside of the system of special education within the Commonwealth. And in the 2 years in question, the record is again silent with regard to, it is not silent with regard to that. There were none in the 2 years in question with regard to that.
Mr. Feinberg, putting Section 1981 and Runyon against McCrary to one side for the purpose of my question, do you think the school could, consistently with the 14th Amendment in 1983, reject children on the basis of race?
For these purposes, yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
I would suggest to the court that for these purposes, this school is a private school and is protected by the First Amendment's rights of free association and a right to pursue an independent educational policy, including that kind of discriminatory policy. Now, in addition to McCrary, there's also, of course, state law, which would preclude them, in this instance, from that kind of discrimination on the basis of race and the and if there were such petitioners, they would have their remedy under state law.
Do you rely at all on the fact that this is a teacher discharge case rather than a student rejection case?
I'm not sure I understand the...
Well, do you think the constitutional issue would be any different if the plaintiff were not a teacher who was denied employment for speaking out against the school policy, but rather were a child who had been denied admission because of his race or religion?
I think, Your Honor, that it would be a... It would certainly be a different kind of a case in the sense that, at least with regard to the child, the entitlement program would certainly is directed toward providing services to the child, as the First Circuit distinguished the child from the teacher. But for purposes of the state action requirement, that threshold inquiry would be the same, Your Honor. And under that threshold inquiry, the argument of the respondents here would be that the school still would retain its private quality and it would make no constitutional difference.
Well, putting perhaps the same question in a little different form, if the Wilmington parking case had not involved discrimination against a patron but rather had been firing an employee or something, you'd say that case would still equally apply to a discharge of an employee? You don't think the Constitution draws any distinction based on the character of the claim anyway when you're analyzing the state action issue?
No, not necessarily, Your Honor. What I would suggest, however, is that the Wilmington case is substantially different from this case in the sense that in the Wilmington case, we were talking about the closeness of the relationship between the entity and the state, whereas here the major argument of the petitioners is that there's been a delegation or a farming out, as Mr. Carroll indicated, of the function. And under that kind of analysis of the public function doctrine concept under Flagg Brothers and under the election cases, that kind of analysis would indicate that we would have to have here a delegation, a whole full delegation of the public function, a function that was exclusively given over to in the state's hands. That is exactly the opposite of what we have here. In this instance, what we have is a situation in which historically the education of handicapped children has never been a public function. Historically, indeed, the education of such handicapped children has always been in private hands, and such children were routinely excluded from the public sector.
You say always. You're talking about the whole 50 states?
No, I'm talking about Massachusetts, Your Honor.
You didn't say so. I thought you...
I'm sorry. My expertise and knowledge in this area is limited to the Commonwealth of Massachusetts for these purposes. But within that context, the state has never entered into this field until the very recent past. And when it did, under Chapter 766, what it did was to encourage an outreach to the private sector rather than incorporate it into its public school system. What it was doing here by establishing a special education program was to say, we cannot do it alone, and we establish an entitlement program whereby if we can't do it, we will seek in every way we can to find an appropriate placement for a child in the private sector and pay for it. And that is exactly what has happened in this instance.
Well, now I can see why the answer to Mr. Justice Stevens' question by you. You couldn't do that on race.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm
Gaines against Missouri says if you've got a school, you can't relegate the Negro to some other school. You have to let him in that school.
But, Your Honor...
So I see why you don't want to get the admission in there.
But, Your Honor, even though I would suggest to the court that when we talk about the discrimination cases, We are not talking about the same generic kind of case that this is. This is a state entitlement program that is neutral on its face. It is not a situation in which we are dealing at all with a discriminatory practice by the school with regard to the admission of students. And in that sense, we don't have to face any of the issues that are raised in those cases. Your Honor,
would you concede, Mr. Feinberg, that the school acts in the form of state action with respect to any function at all?
I would not, Your Honor. I would not in the following sense. With regard to all of its essential functioning, and I've already gone through the admission practice, but in addition, with regard as well to its educational plan and with regard to its personnel practices. And I would suggest to the court that those are the three major functions of any school, private or public, in terms of its decision-making authority. That the private board of directors and the privately employed staff of that school make those decisions. Who goes to the school? What is taught at the school? The philosophy of the school? The educational program? And who indeed teaches at the school? Who is hired and fired?
Do you think that the Court of Appeals adopted such an extreme view in its opinion?
I believe the Court of Appeals concerned itself with the question of whether or not, indeed, if a student was making a claim against the school, the circumstances might be different for purposes of a state action analysis. And indeed, under the nexus theory of this court, that I would concede that that would be a very, very different question. We are here, however, under a public function doctrine analysis primarily, and I have assumed that the petitioners have largely conceded the nexus argument under Jackson and the symbiosis argument under Burton for purposes of this argument. And it is for that reason that I have focused on the exclusivity aspect of this school's functioning and or the lack of exclusivity and the other aspects and elements of that doctrine.
Do you know of any other governmental function that's in private hands that the government pays 99% of the cost?
Your Honor, I could not cite that for you, but I would suggest strongly that there are a number of companies, for example, the bridge building company, that may very well depend almost exclusively on the state for its funding. There are certainly many areas in the private sector that, for example, a drugstore that provides...
I didn't know that bridge building was a governmental function.
I would agree with you, Your Honor, that it is not. But when we talk about the question...
I mean, for example, could you turn the police department over to a private company?
I would suggest, Your Honor...
And give that company 99%?
I would suggest, Your Honor, that you would have a very different case in that instance because there would be a delegation of something that we would all agree would be a traditional and almost exclusively governmental
function. Well, how long
has
Massachusetts been in the business of educating? I know since 1855.
Well, it's been in the business of educating, Your Honor, for some 300 years.
That's what I thought.
And the first 100 years of that educating was done exclusively in the private sector. It was only approximately 200 years ago that the public school system began to arise within the Commonwealth, and it has always been a parallel function
ever
since.
Well, you think that helps you?
I think, Your Honor, the fact that there is...
Well, why did they all of a sudden shop it out? Why did they all of a sudden... Have they shopped out any other part of the educational system?
Certainly, Your Honor, in the sense that since the 1860s, public funds have been made available to private schools for the purpose of educating handicapped children. There has always been a relationship between the public and private sector when it came to handicapped children.
I thought you said that this was the first time the state took over the education of handicapped children.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. That is not my position, and it is not, in fact, the historical truth. The reality is that the state has had a trickle of public funds involved in the education of these children for some years.
Now to my question. What other part of public education has Massachusetts shopped out to somebody else?
Well, I would suggest, Your Honor, that the phrase...
I don't want a suggestion. I want an answer.
I don't believe that the Commonwealth of Massachusetts has shopped out its educational function in this instance, Your Honor, and I don't believe that it has shopped out its function in any instance other than in the sense that private and parochial schools and private schools such as the New Perspective School are assisting the state in carrying out a function...
Did the state set up parochial schools?
No, it does not, Your Honor, but
well,
certainly...
Well, the state said this one up, didn't it?
No, it did not, Your Honor.
It just passed the statute.
It did not... This school, Your Honor, was set up prior to the passage of the statute.
How much prior?
1971, Your Honor.
How many years is that?
That was 3 years prior to the operation
That's
of the statute.
That's a long time.
Your Honor, it's long enough to indicate to respondents...
That somebody can make some money.
Your Honor, if Your Honor, please, it's long enough to... Indicate to the respondents that the purpose of the school was not set up to take advantage of the Chapter 766, but was set up by a group of private parents to obtain an alternative in the private sector for children who are either incapable or unable to attend public schools. And in that sense, Your Honor, this school fulfills a function in the best tradition of the pluralistic, creative aspects of the private sector. It is a school which performs an important service, not a public function in the exclusive state sense, but an important service in the public interest sense. And in that sense, Your Honor, Chapter 766 did not intend that this school be incorporated into the public school system, and only intended that this school become a partner with the public school system to assist in the education of the most difficult children to educate in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
You made a mistake. You said become a part of the educational system.
I'm sorry. I said a partner.
A partner
in the educational system.
Before this school was organized, before the statute was passed, what happened to children such as those that now go to the school?
Some of those children, Your Honor, did not go to school. Some of them were routinely excluded from school. Some, if they could, paid for private schools at their own expense, at their family's expense. And indeed, it was not until the passage of this statute that it was made compulsory that such children attend school at all. So there was a variety of dead ends, if you will, for such children, other than those who could afford to pursue a private education.
Are there other schools in Massachusetts identical to this particular school?
Yes, Your Honor. There is a list at the back of Amicus's brief that would indicate a wide variety of schools, some of which are well known throughout the country, such as the Perkins School for the Blind, that have been providing private education for literally over 100 years in Massachusetts to children such as the children at New Perspective School. The only difference between these schools is the amount and degree of public referral. The New Perspective School fortuitously, and I suggest that it is fortuitous, that the New Perspective School in the 2 years in question had such substantial public funding. At base, indeed, the petitioner's petition comes down to just that, to the question of whether or not this school falls within the state action rubric of the 14th Amendment on the grounds of its substantial public funding. And in that sense, I would suggest to the court that this school is no different from any other state entitlement program, and in that sense, the amount of funding is not a relevant consideration here, given the nature of this entity. For example, with regard to what we have in Massachusetts as a Medicaid program, there is the same analogy can be made. That is to say, in the Medicaid program, a beneficiary qualifies for services. The state then will provide those medical or health services and make a direct payment to the health provider. That health provider is no different in in its service and the importance of its service to the community than the New Perspective School.
Then you're suggesting that if the petitioner's argument were adopted, the possibility of private hospitals, which receive a large percentage of their income from government sources, might likewise be subject to the state action?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I would suggest that that's precisely the result. In fact, and indeed, I think we could come to the absurd result of the corner drugstore dispensing a Medicaid prescription being subject to the state action requirement of, and being subject to the 14th Amendment.
But your opponent conceded that if it were simply one out of 50 students in the school which got state aid, he wouldn't argue for the state action application.
I would suggest, Your Honor, that to play that numbers game would be a very dangerous game. In the first place, of course, whether there's one or 100 students in the school who are publicly funded, the nature of the school remains the same.
But we have one here where 100% of the children are assigned by the state, and where one point less than 100% of the money comes from the state. That's this case, and no numbers game will help you on that.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Would you answer my question when you have a chance?
Thank you, Your Honor.
With that in mind.
The second... The realities of dealing with a mixed school are that the party or the child who comes to that school, because it's the correct school for that child, perhaps or perhaps not, fortuitously, depending upon the percentage and the cutoff point, has his entire school subject to state action in the 14th Amendment and what I would suggest to the court are the considerable restraints that would be imposed on a more freewheeling educational policy at that school. And in that sense, certainly such a result would impact adversely and unfairly upon the private person who simply wants to obtain the best placement for his or her child. I might also add, Your Honor, that to play with the percentages, what a school need do to avoid the restraints of the 14th Amendment would be to hold open 2 or 3 or 5 or whatever number of places would be necessary for a private referral in order to avoid the 14th Amendment. So that what we have in dealing with that kind of problem is a situation in which the 14th Amendment is either on the one hand easily circumvented, or on the other hand, a system in which the schools are fortuitously either in or out of the 14th Amendment, simply depending upon what percentage this court would impose upon the school as one which triggers the 14th Amendment. The two other aspects of this case that I think are important to bring forward are that in no sense does this school perform a delegated function under the public function doctrine. There has been no delegation in the ordinary sense that word is used, for example, in the Flagg Brothers versus Brooks case, the election cases in Marsh versus Alabama. In those cases, there was either on the one hand a complete abdication of the state's functioning, or on the other hand, a total absence of the state, for example, in the company town situation. As I've already indicated, Chapter 766, rather than abdicate responsibility, if it stands for nothing else, it stands for an expansion of the state's responsibility in the area of public educating handicapped children. And in that sense, it certainly did not delegate to the private school a function which it assumed. Finally, in the sense in which the statute creates a special education program, it does not delegate any of those functions. It does not delegate the function of approving the school or of placing the school, of placing the child with a particular school. It does not delegate to the New Perspective School the function of identifying children who have special needs. And it certainly does not delegate to the school the function of, other than educating the child, of any of the other functions established by the statute as being those functions that the state is responsible for. That is to say, the identification, testing, and eventual replacement of the child. I'm sorry?
How is the identification done?
The identification is done, Your Honor, if it is a public referral, it is done within the context of the public school system.
Well, precisely how in the public school system are the children identified who are then sent to New Perspective?
Usually they are identified, at least with regard to New Perspective School, as children with severe behavioral problems, children who have either alcohol problems, drug problems,
yes,
and the like.
And who precisely does the identification?
The public school system would, in the first instance, identify a child who is incapable of continuing on in the public school.
The parents get in that act, too?
The parents are absolutely in that act, Your Honor. In fact, one of the major goals of Chapter 766 is to involve the parents as advocates and as participants in a process. And I might add that if the parents do not approve of the placement at the New Perspective School, they have administrative remedies to have the child go to some other school on their own, quite apart from
And suppose the school decides not to make the referral. Are there administrative remedies to the parents to have that reviewed?
Yes, there are. In other words, absolutely, Your Honor.
And by whom is the review made?
It is, in the first instance, an administrative review, and ultimately it is a judicial review by the court. So that both the school itself does not necessarily get into the act of approving until the parents have already decided that this would be an appropriate placement. And
parents or the school board is deciding?
Both.
But the school board has to decide, does it not, that such a referral is appropriate?
A referral is appropriate, whether to the New Perspective School or some other school. Indeed, Your Honor, placements can be made outside the state of Massachusetts to other private entities in New Hampshire or adjoining states if that were the only placement that this child...
Does that happen very often?
It does not happen often, but it is not an uncommon experience. For example, for the town of Brookline to be paying for a child's education, I know of one example in the state of Maine, where a child is going to school in the state of Maine at the expense of the town of Brookline.
And what kind of school in Maine? Public school?
No, these would all be private schools, Your Honor. In conclusion, Mr. Justice Marshall in the Jackson case stated, private parties performing functions affecting the public interest can often make a persuasive claim to be free of the constitutional requirements applicable to governmental institutions because of the value of preserving a private sector in which the opportunity for individual choice is maximized. The 14th Amendment stands as both a shield and a sword. It's a restraint against state power, but at the same time, it's a protection for the right to privacy and the right of free association of private institutions such as the New Perspective School to be free to follow an independent educational policy free from state interference. Part of the purpose of Chapter 766 was to bring the diversity, the individuality, and the creativity of the private sector to bear upon an important community problem, the need to upgrade the educational opportunities of handicapped and disabled children. The 14th Amendment, it is submitted by the respondents, was never intended to burden this kind of outreach by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to private schools such as New Perspective School. Rather, the 14th Amendment and the First Amendment, respondents suggest, encourages that kind of outreach. The 14th Amendment ought not to be invoked to challenge the school's authority to pursue an independent educational policy. Rather, the 14th Amendment here acts as a shield to protect and nurture such private schools from interference by the state. Thank you, Your Honor.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Carl?
Yes, thank you.
You have about 3 minutes remaining.
Thank you. I'd like to respond first briefly to the argument that the provision of education by the school in this case is constitutionally indistinguishable from the provision of any other service subsidized by the state. When the state provides service, financial assistance to persons in need of services, such as medical care, it ordinarily does not thereby assume any obligation to provide the service itself. Therefore, unlike the provision of education by the school in this case, a private physician is not discharging an obligation of the state when he provides medical care to Medicaid recipients. However, in this, under the statutory scheme we're dealing with here, the school committee is the one who, as a last resort, must provide the education if it cannot find anyone else to do so.
But we still get back to the provision of streets and roads in the city. You think that's a public obligation?
I believe it is in most circumstances.
Well,
certainly
how about
obligation.
Then we're back to our superintendent of the job. Aren't we?
Well, I would say that you must separate the function. That if a company is retained by a city to repair potholes in streets and
roads. So your position necessarily goes that far anyway?
Yes, it goes that far. Not for all purposes, but to the extent the private entity is performing services which affect the quality of the service that the state is itself obligated to provide, then citizens have a right to expect that service will be provided in accordance with the same constitutional obligations as the state.
I notice in the amicus brief that lists all the members of this association. Under the behaviorally disordered group of schools, there are three that I noticed: St. Anne's Home, St. Mary's Home for Children, St. Vincent's Home and School. Could assume they got most of their students from the state. I don't know whether that's true or not. Could they decline to take any except Catholic children?
Yes, I would apply a balancing approach to that kind of a problem.
You balance the First Amendment on this?
Balancing rights protected by the First Amendment, including freedom of religion and freedom of religious association, against freedom of speech. It's the kind of problem that the court alluded to in Norwood versus Harrison, under which it was considered impermissible to lend textbooks to private schools which segregated on the basis of race. But it was not.
But under your analysis, these schools would be engaged in a state function. It'd be state action. And they could discriminate among students. And how about their employees? They could only hire persons of the same faith, for example.
Yes, I would make an exception for countervailing First Amendment interest based upon freedom of religion. I think that would be a necessary exception.
And how about, could you make the students salute the flag?
I think that the rule there would be the same as it would be in the ordinary public school, and I understand that to be no.
Or the school prayer?
There, too, the answer would be no.
Well, but suppose that the Catholic schools required that as a part of the training.
With the exception that if it is organized as a sectarian school, yes, that the First Amendment would create that exception, or we would recognize that exception because of the First Amendment protection of freedom of religion.
Just one more question, Mr. Carroll. Except for the source of payment, is the relationship of the teachers in this school any different, or is it the same as the relationship of teachers in other private schools? I'm talking about the relationship between the school and the teachers now.
It is a contractual relationship. I don't believe that the teachers in this school would be protected by, for example, the tenure provisions of the Commonwealth's education law. So in that respect, the relationship would be different. These would be, as I understand it.
I'm not comparing them to public schools. Are the teachers in this school, the relationship of the teachers in this school, the same as other private schools to the teachers?
I know of no differences except the additional certification requirements.
And except that the source of the funds is a difference.
Certainly, and that the teachers must implement educational programs prescribed by the state rather than by the school itself.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next.